bilateral in nature. They share a long boundary in India's north and China's south. Basically, it is the mountainous region, Himalayan range. And these problems cannot be resolved through third-party intervention or mediation. These are problems which India and China will have to resolve bilaterally. And there has been some negotiations and talks, you know, which are institutionalized, which are going on between both New Delhi and Beijing. So the question of Russia's mediation, in my understanding, does not arise here, because both India and China do not necessarily want a mediator at this point of time. They are ready to talk bilaterally and might be able to resolve their problems bilaterally.
Dr. Gama, recently the director of Indian intelligence agency, Lieutenant General Rana, indicated to the expansion of defense cooperation between Tehran and New Delhi. So what's your take on this?
India and Iran, friendly countries. They have very strong partnership and cooperation in various domains, be it bilateral trade, economy, or even in terms of energy. Even though that energy partnership has led to been disrupted because of external factors, but if you look at Iran's location and India's location, they are basically neighbors. And if you look at the history of the partnership between India and Iran, they are very, very strongly embedded in the regional cooperation between the Gulf region and the South Asia region. And this is something very important. Now, as far as security issues are concerned, India and Iran are both interested in security of the Western Indian Ocean, of the Persian Gulf, of the Arabian Sea, and the entire maritime zone in this area. And in that sense, there is certainly a possibility of partnership between India and Iran. In some ways, it already exists through the Indian Ocean Rim Association and as well as through some bilateral engagement. If we recall, India's Defense Minister Rajnath Singh was in Tehran some time back, a few years back. Iranian Defense Minister also has visited India. So if you look at the possibility of the two countries engaging in certain defense-related cooperation, security-related cooperation, it very much exists. And there is always some discussion between India and Iran on security.
Last but not least, Dr. Gama, we are witnessing major geopolitical changes in the Indian Ocean. So to what extent will these changes bring Tehran and New Delhi closer?
The Indian Ocean region is a very, very important region as far as global geopolitics is concerned, Asian geopolitics is concerned. If you look at the Indian Ocean region, this is one of the most important, most vital global maritime routes for, you know, shipping and international trade. It connects Asia, both South Asia and Southeast Asia, and then North Asia to Africa, to the Mediterranean, to the Arabian Peninsula and Western Asia, as well as to Europe. And then if one goes beyond Africa to also the Latin America and Western Africa. So in terms of geopolitics, this is very, very significant region. And there are a lot of things going on between in this region over the past few years. There is a certain alignment between countries which have common interests, such as India, Japan, Australia, and the US, which is an external power, but is still present in this region. And there are European countries also which are interested in this region. Now, when it comes to Iran, I mean, its geography, and its location, plus being a resource-rich country. If you look at its demography, its history, its civilization, it has always been involved in the geopolitics of Southwest Asia region, which is, if you look at Indian Ocean littorals, the region which, if the broader Indian Ocean region is defined in a broader terms, Iran automatically becomes part of this region.
On that note, I would like to thank Dr. Ghamar from Manohar Parrikar Institute for Defense Studies and Analyses. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see what people have to say around the world.
Takhseti Abdelghani tweeted, Indian Army Chief of Staff, the alliance between Russia and China is attracting Iran, and these two countries are getting closer to forming their alliance, with Iran joining, working to expand bilateral military cooperation. Dr. Shahid Siddiqui wrote, on Army Day, Ambassador of Iran said the defense relations between the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Republic of India are going through a growing process in the framework of the comprehensive relations between the two countries. Spryder tweeted, Turkish politician, our future is in Asia. The leader of Turkey's Vatan Party said that Ankara's destiny is an Asian civilization, which is now emerging under the leadership of Russia, China, Iran, and India. Doğu Perinçek called NATO membership not freedom but captivity. Sahan Fakul writes, the new world order, 30 countries ready to accept the new BRICS Plus currency. The countries are Afghanistan, Algeria, Argentina, Bahrain, Bangladesh, Belarus, Brazil, China, Egypt, Indonesia, Iran, Kazakhstan, Mexico, Nicaragua, Nigeria, Pakistan, Russia, India, in BRICS Plus.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent here on IRIB English Radio.
Iran and India have long shared a bond rooted in culture, civilization, and political understanding. Currently, their economic ties have taken a center stage, presenting a plethora of opportunities and excellent prospects. Recent statistics have shown a significant growth in trade between these two nations. In his recent visit to Iran, the National Security Advisor to Indian Prime Minister Ajit Doval discussed many issues, including the problems related to bilateral banking, with his Iranian counterpart Ali Shamkhani.
It is evident that the economic collaboration between Tehran and New Delhi is reaching new heights. Bilateral trade between the two countries has witnessed a significant surge in recent years. According to reports in 2022, the total trade volume reached a staggering $2.5 billion, with a remarkable growth rate of 48%. This upward trade trajectory can be attributed to Iran's increased oil exports to India, even in the face of Western sanctions that have posed considerable challenges. The recent meetings between economic experts and members of the Iranian Iraq Chamber of Commerce have shown immense possibilities for collaboration between the two countries. Economic experts on both the sides have highlighted the abundant opportunities for trade and emphasized that the existing trade volume between India and Iran can be elevated to match that of countries like the United Arab Emirates and Turkey. The prospect of joint investments in technology transfer holds immense promise, aiming to benefit both the countries in the long run. India's keen interest in exploring the economic opportunities in Iran underscores their readiness to increase commercial exchanges and capitalize on the untapped potential. The growing relations between India and Iran signal a transformative chapter in their partnership.
As the world witnesses a shifting global economic landscape, India and Iran have been forging closer ties in the realm of trade and finance. Recent developments indicate a growing emphasis on de-dollarization and the use of national currencies for bilateral trade. By prioritizing their national currencies, both the countries demonstrate a mutual commitment to pursue shared economic goals free of external pressures. It also opens avenues for other countries to explore similar alternatives, leading to a more diverse global economic system.
On his recent trip to Tehran, the Indian National Security Advisor Ajit Doval held significant discussions and consultations with Iranian diplomats and policymakers. One of the most important proposals discussed was the activation of a rial rupee mechanism, which is believed to play a pivotal role in facilitating bilateral trade and bolstering economic cooperation between the two countries. The aim is to reduce dependency on traditional currency channels and explore the potential of using national currencies for transactions, thereby solidifying the economic partnership. Ali Shamkhani, the secretary of the Supreme National Security Council of Iran, expressed the country's eagerness to increase the usage of national currencies in trade with India. He stressed that this move would serve the economic goals shared by Tehran and New Delhi. According to economic experts, the potential benefits of moving away from the dollar extend beyond economic autonomy. By conducting trade in the national currencies, India and Iran can safeguard themselves against the volatility of foreign exchange rates, mitigate the impact of international sanctions, and foster stronger economic partnerships. The rupee-rial trade and the de-dollarization present an opportunity for India and Iran to leverage their respective strengths and develop a self-sustaining economic ecosystem. Experts believe that this evolving trade carries immense potential for reshaping global economic dynamics and strengthening bilateral ties.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by the Dean of International Studies School, JNU, Professor Aswini Mohapatra from New Delhi. Thank you for being on the program, Professor. Now, Iran and India share a long history of partnership. What has changed in recent years, and what is the current state of relations between the two countries?
If you say current state of affairs, state of relation between the two countries, I think there are sufficient signs of improvement in the bilateral relation between the two countries. After some kind of differences or misunderstanding over these Chabahar deal in, say, 2019 and between 2019 and 2021, I think things are improving. Because you need to understand the bilateral relation between Iran and India are, you know, firmly rooted in their civilizational ties and the cultural similarities in many ways, and the mutual appreciation, admiration of each other, their historical background, and the cultural aspect of it. So that apart, in the contemporary period, if you say Iran and India on pages of regency together, notwithstanding the change of regime in Iran, notwithstanding the fact that, you know, the major political party in India has been replaced by the opposition party, for example, the NDA in the last 10 years. But the relation between two countries, nevertheless, have remained, I think, as usual. And certain points of time, we have seen the sudden surge in the bilateral ties between two countries. And because of the external factors than the bilateral differences, the relation between two countries has been humbled.
Professor, given the recent surge in trade between India and Iran, what factors contributed to this growth, and how do you see or foresee this trend shaping the future economic landscape of the both nations?
Future landscape, you see, there are areas where both the countries can together develop the economic relations, trade ties. At the same time, the two countries together can involve the like-minded countries around, okay, either in the form of a kind of economic grouping or in an informal kind of, say, the community of countries together. to expand their economic and commercial ties. And specifically, I would like to identify the areas like, India until Iran until recently happened to be the second largest exporter of energy to India, oil particularly to India. And the Indian government of late has been trying hard to revive that. They kind of making Iran as one of the major source of energy to India. And second is, for example, the two countries together can work in the area of connectivity, in the area of manufacturing, and in the area of, for example, digitalization, where you'll find India has been doing significantly well across in the world today in terms of digitalization of economy, digitalization of these, the administrative structure, or for example, that's reaching out to the people in India through this digitalized economy. So here, this area also, India can contribute a lot to the Iranian side.
Professor, let's also talk about the activation of a rial rupee mechanism, which has been proposed to facilitate bilateral trade. In your opinion, what are the potential benefits and challenges associated with implementing such a mechanism?
Potential benefit, I think you must be knowing about it. So that's facilitate better trade relations between the two countries without any external interference in terms of conversion of the local currency, be it rial or rupee, into dollar. And the dependence on that particular currency, that's one aspect of it. And second, this is what, in a way, the two countries have been engaged in and what is normally called the barter system. So that could be extended further to make this kind of exchange as a kind of useful mechanism to expedite trade relations between the two countries. But the problem here is because Iran has come under certain sanction, particularly sanction like SWIFT.
Last but not least, Professor, recently the two sides discussed the untapped potential for collaboration in various sectors. So what are the specific areas where India and Iran can leverage their strengths and forge mutually beneficial partnerships beyond traditional trade?
Say, speculative questions, you see. The international politics is full of uncertainty. And as I mentioned earlier, the contemporary global order is fragmented and fluid. So it does offer opportunities as well as certain limitations. And the opportunities only are not linked to the state of relationship the two countries here. Because the relationship also to some extent is constrained or in a way facilitated by the favorable or the unfavorable international system. And there are certain areas, as I mentioned before, that where both the countries can come together and work on expediting the relationship. As I mentioned before, the connectivity. We have these international north-south transport corridor, and how to, the agreement signed where we can do 2002.
There you have it, Professor Aswini Mohapatra from the International Studies School, JNU, in New Delhi. Thank you for being on the program, Professor. Now let's see what people have to say on social media.
Deblina Sarkar wrote, "Hats off to Ajit Dawal, sir. India is now going to trade in Indian rupee with Iran. U.S. can continue to do what it wants." Shining Star tweeted, "Ajit Dawal in Tehran. India-Iran hold talks for rial rupee mechanism for trade, economic cooperation, connectivity, Chabahar port project, Afghanistan. U.S. will not like this." Ritupurna Bharat Sarma wrote, "Trade an important tool for strengthening relation. India and Iran bilateral Exim trade grew by 48% to reach $2.5 billion in 2022. Bilateral trade can touch $30 billion between two if regulate rial rupee payment. India playing an important role for Iran trade amidst U.S. and Western sanction upon Iran."
And that was our episode on the growing alliance between Iran India, Russia and China, and also Iran and India moving towards local currencies in their trade deals. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Russian Finance Minister Anton Silonov has said EU's short-sighted policy is hurting the bloc more than Moscow. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay with us, please. RT noted the West is running out of options for targeting Moscow after multiple rounds of sanctions backfired instead of crippling the Russian economy as intended. Finance Minister Anton Silonov told RT recently. All these restrictions have boomeranged, he argued, noting the worsening cost of living crisis in Western countries, soaring inflation, and a decline in living standards. Silonov added, therefore, these countries are pursuing a short-sighted policy, introducing regular packages of restrictions and sanctions. According to the finance minister, Russia is pursuing an independent policy, trying to minimize the impact of the restrictions that are being introduced against it. Therefore, we are developing our financial independence in the face of a tight budget and budgetary rules targeted inflation. Russian finance minister said, noting that the Russian government is also seeking independence in terms of payment instruments. He said, when Western countries introduce new packages of restrictions, we take anti-sanction measures and we see that we are succeeding. Insisting that Russian economy would reach positive growth rates this year in 2023. He also pointed to low inflation, which is lower than in Western countries, and the lowest unemployment rate, adding that real wages in Russia are growing. He said, therefore, our policy of responding to the sanctioned packages is yielding results. We see that we are headed in the right direction. According to Silonov, there is a change in global geopolitical formations where countries with developing economies are squeezing out the so-called developed nations, with the latter introducing various restrictions and sanctions, including in settlements. However, those restrictions have diminished global confidence in the US dollar and the euro, he said. Russia has also been forced to replace settlements in so-called freely convertible currencies with settlements in reliable currencies. For us, a reliable currency is the national currency and the currencies of friendly countries that have no problems in transferring money for goods and services supplied, he said. We'll be right back. Commenting on Russia's push for de-dollarization, Silanov explained that the abandonment of the dollar and the euro is proceeding gradually. He stated, "We do not set ourselves the task of giving them up tomorrow. We use them, but we are trying to switch to more reliable units of account." The finance minister noted that Russia and China are settling about 70% of their economic transactions in their national currencies and will continue to do so. According to Bloomberg, sanctions imposed on Russia are pushing the global economy closer towards a major crisis, Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov recently said. The official was commenting on reports that G7 members are considering a near-total ban on exports to Russia. Peskov told journalists when asked about the potential G7 embargo, "We realize that the U.S. and nations in the EU are considering new additional sanctions. All sanctions which have been imposed on our nation and new moves which may be under consideration at the moment in Brussels and Washington will certainly hit the world economy too." He added, "That can only exacerbate the trends towards a world economic crisis." Also, according to Press TV, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has admitted that economic sanctions used against countries by the U.S. put the dollar's dominance at risk. As the U.S. has continued to weaponize the dollar, countries are seeking alternatives, from creating new common currencies to using local currencies. Nations are trying to find a safe and equitable way to trade instead of being at the whims of a hegemony that can decide overnight to confiscate a country's money or cut it off from the international financial system. Russia launched its de-dollarization policy when the West slapped economic sanctions against the country. After Russia launched its special operation in eastern Ukraine in February 2022, the U.S. led a massive wave of financial sanctions against Moscow. The biggest moves were the decision by the West to freeze nearly half of Russia's foreign currency reserves and also the removal of major Russian banks from SWIFT, an interbank messaging service that facilitates international payments. The backdrop of sanctions introduced by Western regimes against Russia, a major global energy producer and exporter, prompted China to decide to ditch the dollar in international trade as well. Bank of Russia records show that the Chinese yuan has become a major player in Russian foreign trade. India, a major importer of Russian energy, has also taken several steps towards shifting away from the greenback to rubles and rupees in mutual trade with Moscow.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to yet another episode of Islamic Upbringing. Well, in this program, we answer the questions that you have related to the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified family. Well, today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to invite Professor Salman Nakavi, who is a faculty member at the Al-Mustafa University. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much.
Professor, you have been helping us with the tips of self-defense, how our children can defend themselves in the societies they are living in, because not every day is a good day. Sometimes our children face with the situations wherein they have to deal with the things themselves. And what we have been discussing in the previous episode was very important, the ability to say no, which is a very important self-defense tool. The ability to say no, you helped us a lot on that. And do we have some more self-defense mechanisms that are to be taught to our children?
So self-defense is both coming from within as a personal strength, as an internal strength from within, which starts with self-respect and self-dignity. It starts with confidence in one's own abilities. So it is important that we need to be able to have that confidence in ourselves from our internal strengths, from the confidence which we can repose in ourselves, in our competencies, in our goals that we have designed for ourselves for a better future in this world and the hereafter. We have prioritized for ourselves certain things which have to be done to achieve success in this world and the hereafter. So this is important for us. And our parents should help us in developing these goals and these priorities.
All right.
They should assist us and guide us and lead the path in doing so. And we should be able to manage our time accordingly. So that internal strength comes, that when we are able, faced with a situation when things are being asked from us, that conflict with this feeling, with this understanding, with these goals and priorities, then we are able to say no.
All right.
But on the other hand, if we are from within ourselves able to break our rules ourselves, and we say, okay, it's a goal that I've set, this is my priority, but let's leave it for tomorrow.
All right. So are you trying to say that?
So if I'm easygoing with my own rules, with my own priorities, then I will not be able to say no to anyone.
All right.
So if I take my own rules and on my own priorities not seriously, then I will also be confronted.
And also the respect.
And maybe when I do want to, somebody asks me for help.
Yeah.
I will, you know, it may be a good deed, it may be a wrong deed. If it's a good deed, yes, it will not go against my goals. But if it's a bad deed, if it's something he's asking me and imposing upon me something and bullying me to do, I will, you know, again, crumble in front of him if I'm not strong from within. And that strength comes from myself, and the strength comes from my elders, who repose confidence in me, and they don't compare with me with others. They take me for what I am and build upon my strengths and make me build upon those strengths.
Right.
Yes, every one of us has weaknesses from within. Everyone has certain weaknesses. Weaknesses have to be overcome. They have to be
worked upon.
And the strengths have to be used
to replace them
and work.
Yeah.
And number two, Physical strength is necessary.
Now, how important is that physical strength, and why is it necessary? We'll ask you after a short break. Now, listeners, stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are with Professor Salman Nakavi, and Professor is discussing with us how important is self-defense in children and what are the mechanisms you can teach them. And now, Professor, you were saying that physical development is very, very important in self-defense.
Yes, exactly. So as far as the internal spiritual strength goes, that is important. Intellectually, we should be strong. Emotionally, we should be in control of ourselves. But of course, physical strength is also important. Physical abilities are the main important. So we need to make our children take proper nutritions. We should be taking them for sports activities and especially for self-defense classes also. And I advise girls for that also, for them to go to self-defense classes as a responsibility, because Islam has said that we need to defend ourselves. And it is not allowed for us to refrain from defending ourselves if we can.
Yeah.
So we need to go for physical strength, physical activities, and parents should give time to their children to develop these physical strengths. And even the posture in which we sit. Yes, we should not sit or walk in a way that shows arrogance.
All right.
But it should show modesty, confidence.
All right.
Our way of walking, our way of talking should be sober, should reflect
modesty plus confidence
and strength and confidence. And another person can't even think of imposing his own will upon us.
Yeah.
So that is important, that we imbibe in our children internal strengths and physical strengths.
Yeah.
And we are able to develop them in a very balanced way. So children, even if they may have not a strong body, it could be, strengthened. Many people with huge figures, they are not strong.
Okay.
Boys with small figures, they are very strong.
Okay.
Because they've developed their strengths, their physical strengths. They've exercised, they've gone for sports. They've gone, developed them. Their mental and physical strength has been developed. And parents play a very major role by taking time out with their children, by leading by example, by taking time out with them, taking them to classes, them to those classes which are important, to gymnasiums, to carry out different exercises which are very good for our health.
Yeah. Well, Professor, we have some very important questions that we have received from New Zealand from a 15-year-old. I'll ask you the question after a short break, dear listeners. Stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم said, Honor your children and teach them good manners.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing, and we are with Professor Salman Nakavi. Professor Salman Nakavi, we have a very important question from New Zealand. This is just a 15-year-old girl, and she is asking that she is on a social media platform wherein she has now a number of followers, and she has learned, as per Islamic teachings, that it's obligatory to say Walaikum Assalam if someone says Salam to you. But is it mandatory on the social media platform as well? Because sometimes I feel like people who are messaging me are not important, or they are just trying to pass their time. So what she's trying to say over here is that now she knows Islamic rulings on talking to people, but she feels like sometimes it's not very important that people are asking the information for. Is it necessary to develop a relationship with those who are just starting with a salam and now they want to develop a relationship with you on the social media platform? So how can she manage that?
So relationships, whether they are in the physical
world
or the virtual world, of course that virtual world is also now a real world. It's a physical world in a sense. So yes, communicating with each other has the same rules as any other relationships have, And you need to take care of the fact that if you're getting into a relationship, it will take you into a situation which is not going to be acceptable as far as religion and Islam goes, then you should avoid it. Answering back to a salam is maybe necessary, but then continuing with the relationship, if it is not going to be of any assistance to you in your goals, then you should, you know, not continue with that. Sometimes saying salam and answering salam is obligatory. Of course, sometimes you have salams in general messages all over the time. You don't need to answer them. But if you,
so it's not mandatory.
If there's a personal message to you and there's a salam to you, you answer that. But to continue that relationship depends upon the red lines that you have.
What I presume, what she's trying to say is that is it necessary to maintain a distance on social media platforms while developing relationships with others, and which could be a form of, you know, self-defense on social media?
Yes, it should be. One should take the precautions, and parents should be careful of their children if they develop such relationships. That is important. I mean, the parents should be on the outlook for such a situation happening or such a relationship developing. And especially girls should be, you know, should be very careful and sensitive about any type of relationship which is developing with girls in the house. And they can see that on the social media. It should be managed, it should be controlled. And the girls should especially confide in their parents that such a situation is happening. Even if they, for example, they've set up a platform, they think they are providing services to society. But, you know, shaitan has his ways. And he can, you know,
trap you from anywhere.
Yes, he can come and influence you and penetrate into you, towards you, and get to you without you even realizing what's happening. So we need to be on the guard. We need to be on the lookout for such an event. That relationships should be very carefully managed. So that is important. Yes.
So those coverings and so those guidelines, respecting those red lines, respecting those Islamic guidelines, is not just confined to the real world. It also applies on the social media world. And you're saying for a girl, it's not very mandatory to be answering each and everything. What she feels like is important, she can share that. And what she feels like is unimportant, she can actually refrain from sharing that or actually texting back rather than thinking that it is a disrespect. It's not a matter of disrespect as per you. And it's a matter of actually staying safe and staying secure like you stay safe in the real world. So one has to be very, very cautious about the social media world as well. Thank you so much, Professor, for being with us and giving us so beautiful advices and helping all the time the children, the parents. So, dear listeners, not just parents, if it's the teens who are listening to us, if it's the children who are listening to us and have issues with the parenting of their parents and have any questions, or even the parents have any questions, so you can actually feel free to email us at the English Radio at the rate of irib.ir, or you can actually listen to our programs again on our official website, which is www.parstoday.ir/en. Go to the tab COI, Call of Islam, and you will find an archive of our programs there. You can also find us on the social media platforms by just typing Call of Islam. Thank you so much for being with us. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space returned upon rest.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the Limelight.
Hate crime, especially against minorities and women in the United States, has become normal practice, and reports show that the number of such crimes increase year after year. Reports from the U.S. media suggest the rate of hate crimes in 2021 and 2022 has increased in dozens of large American cities, and Asian and Black Americans are among the people who are targeted most by these hate crimes. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The website of Yahoo News has covered this story and tells us more. A new report by the civil rights organization says hate crimes in the United States are likely to spike ahead of the 2024 presidential election. The Leadership Conference Education Fund said on Thursday, 27th of April, that FBI data showed an unmistakable pattern of a rise in hate crimes during general elections. The report by the Leadership Conference Education Fund, the research arm of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, stated, "From the mainstreaming of hate and the failure of social media platforms to adequately address disinformation, the current climate is rife with opportunities for a trend of increasing hate crime to continue into the 2024 election cycle, unless action is taken now." The report charts an unmistakable pattern that has emerged during the last four presidential campaign cycles, showing reported hate crimes increase during elections. The data, which draws on findings from 230 national human rights organizations, suggests that from 2008, when Barack Obama, the first Black American president in U.S. history, took office, hate crimes have been on the rise in the United States. The report stated, "Research has shown that the 2008 election cycle served as a rebirth of the anti-government militia movement from the 1990s. The final weeks of the 2008 presidential campaign saw an increase in hate crimes targeting racial and ethnic minorities as the United States elected its first Black president." The report says hate crimes have nearly doubled since 2015. It says a staggering spike came during and after Donald Trump's election campaign, and it has not returned to normal levels before the Trump period. The civil rights group suggests that Black people and Muslims are the main targets of hate crimes in the United States. The Muslim population of the United States has increasingly been the target of Islamophobia and hate crimes in the years following the suspicious 11th of September attacks, 2001. Which unleashed a new era of racism and discrimination against Muslims in the U.S. Stephen Freeman, vice president of civil rights at the Anti-Defamation League, told Yahoo News, "I think that's a responsibility for anybody in a leadership role, anyone who's running for president or office or anyone who's currently in government, to use their pulpit to speak out against hate crimes." Anti-hate groups have urged the U.S. government to make sure that technology giants like Meta, YouTube, and Twitter increase transparency and invest in deplatforming hate for the upcoming local, state, and national elections to address hate crimes. Nadia Aziz, a program director with the Leadership Conference Education Fund, told Yahoo News that Barack Obama's 2012 re-election campaign empowered white nationalists and provided them with a platform. Nadia Aziz said, "A lot of trust and safety teams have kind of been gutted, so we need to make sure, especially going into this election cycle, that these teams that monitor disinformation and safety and content are rebuilt. She added, "We just really need to make sure that they're prepared for what's to come." Michael Lieberman, senior policy counsel at the Southern Poverty Law Center, a contributing partner to the report, said, "One of the purposes of the report is to signal an early warning about what we can see and what we can predict." Michael Lieberman added, "Knowing how the election cycles have brought out hate and normalized hate in the past, and what that meant in terms of actual violence being directed against people on the basis of their personal characteristics, we need to make sure that we are doing everything we can as a government, as a community-based organization, to make sure that we are prepared for the 2024 election cycle." The New York Times has also covered this story and tells us more. A new report by the Federal Bureau of Investigation, FBI, says the frequency of hate crimes across the United States saw a record increase throughout 2021, especially those motivated by bias against black people. The FBI said recently that more than 10,000 instances of hate crimes were reported during that year, reflecting an 11.6% overall increase. The percentage reflected a 31% increase from 8,263 cases the previous year, while the year-on-year increase in hate crimes was the largest in more than three decades. The report added that 64.5% of victims in 2021 were targeted because of their race, because of their ethnicity or ancestry bias. It also noted that racist incidents targeting black people comprised the largest number of the incidents, namely 2,233 cases. A separate analysis showed that anti-black crimes were followed in frequency by crimes committed against white people, some 948 cases, crimes committed against the Jewish people, 817 cases, and crimes committed against Asian people, 746 cases. The agency also recorded 152 hate crimes targeting Muslims in the United States, with a total of 190 victims, which added up to about one in every 20,000 Muslims. The FBI's new analysis marks the first time the Bureau has been confidently reporting national hate crime trends since it transitioned to a new data collection system. The FBI said in a news release, of the 8,327 hate crime offences classified as crimes against persons in the updated 2021 dataset, 43.2% were intimidation cases, 35.5% were simple assault cases, 20.1% were aggravated assaults. FBI officials said they typically track the 130 most populous cities across 16 states in the United States to identify statistically significant trends. Of those, 96 cities were able to provide data for the new report. America's two largest cities, namely New York and Los Angeles, are now included in the hate crime analysis reported recently, while Chicago was able to provide two quarters worth of data for the report. Jonathan Greenblatt, chief executive of the Anti-Defamation League, says the report confirms that hate crimes in the United States reached record high levels in 2021.
Aperture. Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we witnessed that abuse by law enforcement officers in the United States is one of the most serious and divisive human rights violations in the country, as U.S. police is killing black people at persistently high rates. What is clear is that racism is at the very heart of the issue, as statistics show that black people are 3 times more likely to be killed by police than white people. What is worse is that even black children are being targeted. Yet the people have not been silent. They have organized in what is known as the Black Lives Matter campaign to get the message across that all lives are of equal value, no matter the color of the skin. Stay with us for the rest of the program.
So we were just going over some things for the vigil. It's going to be in Nicholas Hayward Jr. Park. That's in Brooklyn. He was murdered by the police, 13-year-old murdered by the police for like really similar circumstances, very close parallel to what was happening with what happened with Tamir Rice. So it's important for me, I think, that place be chosen and that his story be highlighted. So to that end, I'm always trying to connect the dots so that people see, yes, this is a national issue, but this is also a local issue. So his father's going to be speaking. We'll have a prayer by Pastor Omar, words from Mr. Hayward, I'm sorry, and then I'll close out talking about the national epidemic of police violence against children. And this is why I wanted us to meet, so that we could talk about things that I may be overlooking. Well, for one, I've applied for a permit with the Parks Department. You guys know that's always important to me, but I also wanted to get your input on that. We had issues with the permit with the march, lots of fighting with the Parks Department and the Police Department. And so they haven't been responsive yet, so I'm wondering if we're going to encounter the same issues that we did with the 4-mile march. The reason why I choose places of public accommodation is because we have a legal right to be there. And so, like, you know, there's nothing that they can really do about us exercising our First Amendment right within a space of public accommodation. Glad that the weather held up.
Thank God, because yesterday was terrible.
Yeah, I thought it was going to rain.
Imagine if yesterday would have been today.
Probably. Yeah, and lugging all of this stuff in the rain, and I know it would have been a terrible turnout.
But get ponchos.
Yeah. Exactly. But, you know, people don't show up when it's rainy or cold, so I'm really glad that people have, you know, I think we're going to have a good turnout.
So I'm really excited working with Leah because, you know, you saw her. She's going to be having the weatherproof posters of the children and their stories.
She did a great job.
Yeah. I think that'll be powerful with it tied, like, on the fence so that passerbys, you know, will wonder and come and look, and then they can read the stories.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. She also did an art installation on the floor where she got age-appropriate shoes, like the whatever size of shoe size would be at the age that they were killed, and she painted those white, and those are going to be there too. So it's going to really help you visualize how small these kids were when their lives were stolen.
And I think it's good to focus on the children because this is something that can't be argued. Like,
exactly.
Even you can play devil's advocate, these are children.
Exactly.
Children are harmless. So.
In September 1994, Nicholas Hayward Jr. was shot and killed in a public housing stairwell by an NYPD officer who mistook a plastic toy gun for a real one. Hayward was just 13 years old. Like so many other cases, no one was indicted in connection with the killing. In the 22 years since Hayward's death, his father has struggled with how and why his son died.
I cry a lot. It's hard to deal with losing a loved one. Nicholas was 13 years old. It pains me every time I hear of another victim being killed. My son was a great kid. He wasn't causing any harm to anyone. He was doing the right things. You know, he wasn't a danger or a threat to the officer that killed him. So, I mean, I feel that this is something that I have to do. I have to do this. We live in a society that continues to criminalize our youth, despite the fact how much effort they put forward to try to make their own life better. My son was doing the best that he can prior to him being killed. And he told the officer, we're only playing, and he shot and killed Nicholas in mid-sentence. And despite all of the the witnesses who's basically justified what Nicholas was doing, that he dropped the toy gun. They all told the district attorney he dropped the toy gun, and the officer shot him anyway.
I think that actually there is a culture